It's a lot like another Gothic.
It's pretty unique among the public story.
Mark that up right now. Get these things in before.
I can borrow your pen if I could. Now, what are we marking off here?
Where?
See, that's marked off.
Okay. Oh, you already marked off. Okay.
Well, we got that one taken care of.
Good.
Yep.
Good.
The next point here in the Book of Mormon being a literary impossibility would be the nature of the Egyptian writing and the resultant translation. So the nature of the Egyptian writing and the resultant translation. So what we have to realize is this. Hieroglyphics, they're just pictures. So therefore, it's extremely ambiguous. If I try to write a sentence, and I put are going to translate this, how precise can we be? How precise can you be with picture language? You can't be precise. It's extremely ambiguous. How can you get this really down to a word for word saying exactly what was in the mind of the one penning those figures? You can't. Especially when you're going from hieroglyphics to precise 17th century English. And that's the English of the King James. Now remember, Joseph Smith is not in the 17th century. Joseph Smith is in the 19th century. He's living in the 1800s, 200 years removed from the English of the King James. And English has changed a great deal in those 200 years. And you don't find the New American Standard made in the 1960s translated from the 1920s in how English was used then. English has changed over the last 15, 20, 30, 50 years. The translators of New International Version, New American Standard, and other very modern translations are in modern English. They're in present-day English. And English changes very fast. Languages change very fast. It doesn't take that much to change languages because there's different influences. And you can have a war and instantaneously your language will change because there can be a large influx of new servants and you start to acquire their goods, some of their lands, and you're going to acquire a lot of their words. There's a lot of things that will change, and it can change in 5 years. It can change in 10 years very easily, and you can have many, many huge changes in your language. And that's what's happened to languages. And languages are always an expression of where the people are living and how the people think at that time. Joseph Smith did not have a 17th century English vocabulary. He didn't. He had a 19th century vocabulary, because that's where he lived. So how can a man be translating? See, you translate. It's your mind. It's your words. And you're trying to find equivalents in your language for these things, for these pictures. It's not going to come out in 17th century English. And see, there are no such things as inspired translations. There is no such thing. You cannot make the Book of Mormon into that. Now, how can you translate hieroglyphics into 17th century idioms, also with Latin terms and all sorts of other English phrases? How can you do such a thing? How can you have 2 Nephi 10:3 say, it must needs be expedient that Christ should come among the Jews, when there were no Jews as far as what Nephi knew? He left Jerusalem before the captivity in Babylon. And it's from the captivity in Babylon that you have Jews. You don't have Jews before the Babylonian captivity. That word was non-existent. So how can you have that here? See, it cannot be. How could he draw a picture that means Jews? And Joseph Smith translates that. It can't be. He wouldn't have had a picture being Jews. And what would you make them look like? How can you make it Jews? This is an incredible thing. How can you have an Alma, A-L-M-A, Alma 11:24, the word lucre, L-U-C-R-E, which is a Latin word. It's from the Latin lucrum, to gain riches. How can you have that here? How can we get that in here? How do you go from Reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics when you're up here in the 19th century, and then you go back here and have this Latin word as your translation? And how could you ever picture that Latin word in Reformed Egyptian? How can this be? It's impossible. And in Mosiah, M-O-S-I-A-H, Mosiah 29:4, it says, they did wax strong in love. They did wax strong in love. Now, this is a Middle English colloquial, I can't even say the word, but you know what word it is. And we're to wax, and it came from candles burning. And as the candles would burn, the wax would build up. So the word wax means to build up. So how can you have this expression from Old English because of them burning candles, and that's expressed in Reformed Egyptian? How can that be? It can't be there. It's not possible. How can you be in the 19th century and use this 17th century expression that somehow was pictured from Reformed Egyptian? It all goes back to the Reformed Egyptian. It just won't work. And then in 2 Nephi 29:3, it says, a Bible, a Bible. Now, Bible is a Greek word, meaning book. So now how do we get this Greek word in here? How do we get Greek in here? I thought we had Reformed Egyptian, 19th century, but now we got a Greek word. Where did it come from? How does it get in here? And how do you picture it? How do you picture such things? Now, this is supposed to be an absolutely accurate translation. It's supposed to be telling us precisely what was pictured. So how can, from Reformed Egyptian, you picture a Bible? How can you picture somebody waxing strong? Those things, see, they can't be pictured. How can you picture a Jew? He doesn't even exist. See, it can't be done. Where's he getting all this? He's plagiarizing the King James. He's using all sorts of things right out of the King James Bible. It just won't work. See, it's impossible to translate picture language into fine tenses, cases, verbs, adjectives, pronouns, including Hebraisms, figures of speech, and then you look, so you've got all that, and then you look at the King James, and what's the King James from? Hebrew manuscripts, Greek manuscripts. So you got the King James, then you look at the Book of Mormon. They look the same. They sound the same. They really sound the same. But this one, it didn't come from Hebrew. It didn't come from Greek. It comes from Reformed Egyptian. Cannot be. See, it's a translation. You're translating. And you can't take two entirely different things at these incredibly different time periods, 200-year gap, and come up with the same kind of translation. It just can't be done. It's not possible. It's a total impossibility. Many exact statements of the King James are in the Book of Mormon. Exact statements. How can this be from translating Hebrew and Greek and Reformed Egyptian? It just can't be. It cannot happen. It's impossible. The Book of Mormon's translated between 1827 and 1829 into 17th century English. English of the 1600s. Many exact phrases, sentences, verses, even chapters to the King James Bible. Can't be. It claims to be perfectly translated from the Reformed Egyptian. It's impossible. Totally impossible. See, it was a committee of 47 Puritans and Anglicans that put together the King James. And the King James was a compromise translation. It's a compromise. And they were concerned about style, meter, flow, poetry, pentameter. Each person gave reading, discussed alternative translations, and the result was the 1611 King James Bible. And you're going to have the same thing in the Book of Mormon? Can't happen. This can't happen. It can't happen. And you cannot say God did it. God didn't do it. Joseph Smith. The nature of the translation is that it's identical to the King James. That's an impossibility. It can't happen. Can you have these words from take Hebrew into English, Greek into English, and this is pictures into English, and they're identical? It can't happen. And it's also interesting to note, as an example, in 3 Nephi 11, verses 27 and 26, it quotes 1 John 5:7 verbatim. 3 Nephi, chapter 11, verses 27 and 26. It quotes 1 John 5:7, which is totally refuted by all manuscripts. It's not authentic. Verse used by Trinitarians, trying to show these three are one. And this is in 3 Nephi, verbatim. Now, this just was not going to work. And it's also interesting to, well, there's a lot of other ones, but here's just one other. It's interesting. It's not as strong as that one. But in 2 Nephi 16:3, this is coming from Isaiah 6:3. So 2 Nephi 16:3 comes from Isaiah 6:3. And it has the word is. In the statement, in the verse, the word is. Well, in Isaiah, it's italicized. That means it's not in the Hebrew. But it's in 2 Nephi 16:3. See, that shows, he just carried things right over from the King James, and it shows he was ignorant. He didn't know what he was doing. He probably didn't have the slightest idea why words were italicized. He just put them right in. He didn't know what he was doing. He's a good con artist, in a sense. When it comes right down to all the specifics of what he did, he's a liar is what he is. And if you just ask a liar the right questions, you always find out he's a liar. That's what's happened here. Now, if you translate from varied sources, you cannot come up with the same results. Now, what I mean is this. It is impossible for two people to translate from language A. You just have language A. And you take these two people, and they're going to translate from this language, language A. And they're going to translate into language C. It will not be identical. It will not be identical. If we knew two languages, and we had somebody come up here and speak that language, and we had one translator standing next to him to be an interpreter, and he interprets it for us, and we know both languages, and we're just doing this to get this across to us, and the other interpreter is not in the room, so he doesn't know how the first one interpreted. He does not know it word for word. And then the second one comes in. And I'm not just talking about three letters, three words that he's interpreting. I'm talking about maybe interpreting for about 5 minutes. Then you bring the other one in. And the first person says the same thing that he did for the other. They will never be identical. Never, 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 never will they be identical. Because you cannot do that with language. You know anything about language, it can't be done. It can never be done. It's impossible. Now, the Holy Ghost wanted to do it, fine. But we're not dealing with the Holy Ghost when we're looking at the Book of Mormon. Now, what if you have two different languages? And you're going to take these two different entirely languages and translate them. You'll never come up with the same kind type of translation. It can't happen. You cannot have the Greek and the Reformed Egyptian. You've got A and B, and both result in C. It's another impossibility. See, they're just so vastly different, especially when you're dealing with Greek. Greek is so precise. Reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics are just so ambiguous. You can't result in C with both of them. Especially when you separate the translators by 200 plus years. And you've got one over there in England, 47 of them to be exact, a whole committee, and you've got this one lone man in Palmyra, New York. We've been talking to Moroni, digging in the hill Cumorah, looking in his peepstone. You can't result in C. It can't be the same. It can't. Never. Now, some of the things, let me give you one example. You won't be able to really get this down. It just illustrates it. You cannot, and we're talking about these two vastly different systems. We've got the manuscripts for the Bible, and then we have the golden plates for the Book of Mormon. And some of what Joseph Smith did is comparable to this. It really is. It is comparable to this. It'd be like having a picture like this. It is really, and this is not an exaggeration. It's going to sound like an exaggeration, but it's not. It'd be like having a picture like this. And this is how Joseph Smith translated it. It sounds like it's a huge hyperbole, and it's not. Be like, and see, that's what the Egyptian is these pictures. So we got this picture. But this is what this picture is. Okay, and you got this picture. Now we're going to let you know what this is. So it's going to really help you out. Okay, the 4 foot tall young Eskimo warrior, wearing a sealskin coat and no gloves, kindled the fire using flint and wood to ignite 18 dry birch twigs, and it burst into flames of yellow, blue, and red, shedding light in and outside the tent, and it provided heat to warm all 6 children and the dog sled team. Now that's exactly what the Book of Mormon is. And that's how he did it, in a sense. You've got this picture, and he's just got it right down to all of these incredible details. See, what I'm trying to get across to you is you can't do this. It can't be done. You can't take a picture and have this huge, elaborate statement come from it. It's not possible. It can't be done. But that's the Book of Mormon right there. That's exactly the way it is. Cannot happen. Now, if it was Greek, and you're going a word for word, and you expand it, well, now we can get somewhere. But not with pictures. You can't communicate it like that with pictures. You cannot have these pictures. And see, now remember, the point was, he couldn't write in Hebrew, because evidently he didn't have enough space, so he had to resort to these pictures. But the pictures would never convey all of this. It was what was in the writer's mind, if there was such a writer, which there wasn't, But how could Joseph Smith really write all of this? And then it lines up with the King James English. And this would be a huge miracle. And then that means there should be no contradictions in the book. See, even if we could stretch our imaginations and stretch our faith to the wildest limits, say, well, there is a possibility God could do that. Oh, God can do anything. But then the fruit would bear it out. And there wouldn't be the contradictions. And you wouldn't have to change the whole history of the Mormon Church over and over again and erase some things, add other things. You wouldn't have all that. So that when you look at the fruit and it's all rotten, and then you see what the claim is, then you can go back and you can just tear the claim limb from limb because it's just not going to work. That's why you have to do it. So that's what we have there. Now, also the Book of Mormon is an archaeological impossibility. It mentions steel, and they've never found any steel. It mentions silk. There's no way they had silk in America at this time. It mentions elephants. They didn't have elephants. And then you got the Curalams and the Cumams and whatever those were. And then you've got a battle with 2 million Jaredites slain, and you can't find any trace of it anywhere. And then it also mentions synagogues and sanctuaries. And synagogues, that came again after the captivity. So just like the word Jews, it could not be. It also mentions armor. In the battle with the Nephites and the Lamanites, there was armor. And armor, that kind of metal, you should be able to find all sorts of artifacts of that. Can't find any of that. See, there were 38 cities. If you go through the Book of Mormon, you can catalog 38 cities. And these were big cities. They had cement and steel. And these were big cities. And here we have cities in Asia and in all sorts of other parts of the world. And they were made out of mud and clay and dried bricks and material that just more or less could just go right back to the earth. And we find those cities. We find all sorts of traces of those. Pottery. All sorts of things. So you got cities with steel and glass and armor. And they're huge civilizations. You're obviously going to be able to dig them up. You should obviously be able to find them. So that all, it just all shows that it's an archaeological impossibility. The Smithsonian Institute, they won't have anything to do with the Book of Mormon. They said the Book of Mormon is ridiculous. They will not put one bit of confidence in the Book of Mormon. They won't consider it in the slightest. They've written letters of response to people. And they've said, we will have nothing to do with it. It has no validity. And there's a letter addressed to Reverend Odell Brown, pastor of Hillcrest Methodist Church, Fredericksburg, Virginia. And this is the response. Pardon my delay in answering your letter of January 14, 1957. The question which you ask concerning the Book of Mormon is one that comes up quite frequently. However, I may say that I do not believe that there is a single thing of value concerning the prehistory of the American Indian in the Book of Mormon. And I believe that the great majority of American archaeologists would agree with me. The book is untrue, biblically, historically, and scientifically. Concerning Dr. Charles Anthon, I do not know who he is and would certainly differ from his viewpoint as the Latter-day Saints tell it. Remember how I told you? They say Anthon verified it. He wrote a letter and said, no, I don't. But that's just what the reference is here, too. What possible bearing Egyptian hieroglyphics would have on either the Book of Mormon or the prehistory of the American Indian, I do not know. None. I'll be glad to tell him. Didn't have anything to do with it. Now, if you have all sorts of Indian-type paintings in caves, supposedly from prehistoric man and all of that, and if the Jaredites, the Nephites, the Lamanites, all these other people are using Reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics, then there should be traces of that writing everywhere. You should be able to find records of it. It should be so easy to authenticate and to substantiate. There shouldn't be any problem whatsoever. So there's a problem with the fact talking about steel. Steel could not be produced. You need compressed air, and you need huge foundries, and you need heat, incredible heat, to produce steel. It cannot be done. You gotta have these big, huge factories to do it. You don't take some, you don't go visit some tribe in Africa, and instead of having a straw kind of a hut with palm leaf roofs, you find they've got this nice steel building they're living in, and they made the steel right over here on their little fire with their kettle. It can't happen. It's impossible. And see, Joseph Smith, he did not realize there's a point of interest. I don't know if I can find it right offhand. We're looking at it today in Jeremiah, but it talks about steel, and it should be bronze. But Joseph Smith was not aware that it was bronze rather than steel, and so he just wrote it right in to the Book of Mormon. It's in about chapter 14. Or 15 of Jeremiah. I don't remember exactly where it was. But it just can't be. But he was not aware of that, so he just wrote it right in. America was not covered with buildings. That's been confirmed by archaeology. There were no such buildings. There's no elephants found in the New World. There's no armor found in the New World. And that the only time you find armor is after the Europeans came. That was much, 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 much later, another 1,000 years or so. There are no synagogues until after the captivity. There's no trace of the 38 cities. There was no silk in America during this time because there was no shipping to the Orient. In order to have silk, you've got to be able to have some contact with the Orient, or you've got to have silkworms. There just aren't a whole lot of silkworms here in America. They didn't migrate back to the Orient. They were here, of course, you know, and they migrated. They got on some barge and went over to the Orient. I mean, there are no silkworms. They didn't crawl up to Alaska and wait for a boat to cross over into China. No silk. Can't happen. Bible Lands shipped silk from India, who had gotten it from China. But there were no silkworms in Bible Lands, so they couldn't have taken silkworms with them when they left there in 600 B.C. and came here, and they didn't have any. So it's just not a possible thing. Now, here's a quote from a Mormon. And this is recorded in the Utah Christian Tract Society, in one of their tracts. And they're dealing with Mormons. And they quote this from Mormons. This generation has more than 1,000 times the amount of evidence to demonstrate and forever establish the divine authenticity of the Book of Mormon than they have in favor of the Bible. Totally deceived. Totally false. Just incredible. Absolutely incredible. Now, the Book of Mormon is filled also with all sorts of contradictions. And remember, the three witnesses said, we also know that they, the plates, have been translated by the gift and power of God. For his voice has declared it unto us, wherefore we know of a surety that the work is true. So that means if it really came from God, by his power, then there should never be a contradiction. You should never have to make a change. You shouldn't have to do anything with it. Now, Jesus Christ, he said, I speak only the words my Father gives me to speak. But he was having to apologize all the time. You know, He spoke the words his father wanted, but he'd find out the next day his father didn't want to say that. His father had made a mistake, and he had to go and, the father, he just didn't really want to say that. It's what he told me to say, and I was faithful, but he was wrong. And see, that's not what happened, is it? If you speak only what your father gives you to speak, then it's 100% correct. And if you write according to what God wants written, then you should never have to change it. No reason to change it. Why would you have to change it?
The scripture you wanted is Jeremiah 15:12.
Okay, thank you very much. Jeremiah 15:12. And he came across one like that. And here it's got the word steel, and he just put it right in there. He didn't realize that was not something that existed back then. He just wasn't aware, evidently, and put it right into the Book of Mormon. Now, the first edition of the Book of Mormon came out in 1830. And it has undergone extensive correction in the meantime. Extensive. And I'll just mention a couple of these. In Mosiah 21:28, it says, King Mosiah had a gift from God. That's what it says now. But the 1830 edition said the king was named Benjamin. Now it's changed. Actually changed. This is not something where you're explaining an apparent contradiction. This is where you have the 1830 edition and today's Book of Mormon. And that one said Benjamin, and today says King Mosiah. Now, there's no way to explain it. Edition with today's, there are over 50 changes in those verses. 50 changes. Words have been dropped, spelling corrected, words and phraseology added and turned about. Now, this is a very strange way to treat an inspired revelation from God. And you know, God's pretty busy, and to keep track of all the spelling and all the languages, that would be pretty hard. So I can accept that. It's so ridiculous. It's an unfortunate thing. In Alma chapter 28, verse 14, through chapter 29, verse 11, 28:14 through 29:11, there are more than 30 changes from the original. The original edition had a statement was, Yea, decree unto them that decrees which are unalterable. And that whole thing has been removed. That statement doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, does it? Yea, decree unto them that decrees which are unalterable. Decree unto them. That take me a long time to figure that one out. I don't know, maybe you could catch on to that one faster than I could. On page 25 of the 1830 edition, I don't know the reference, just here in this listing, it just says on page 25 of that edition, you have, and the angel said unto me, Behold the Lamb of God, yea, even the Eternal Father, which that would be a good revelation of the dual nature. However, they don't believe in the dual nature, nor do they believe in the Trinity. So they've changed it now, and it says, Yea, even the Son of the Eternal Father. Complete change. Completely changed it. And also on that same page, it says, Behold, the Virgin which thou seest is the Mother of God. That's what it said originally. So Mary's the Mother of God. But now it reads, Is the Mother of the Son of God. There's another change. And that's the way the book is. All the way through. Change after change after change. Joseph Smith said the Book of Mormon is the most correct of any book on earth. Except for all the changes that have to be made, of course. And he said it's the most correct, period. Most correct book. If you compare the 1830 edition with the current editions, there's over 3,900 changes. 3,900. Now that's what you expect when you're dealing with translations. But not when you're dealing with something that is spoken of in such high terms as the Book of Mormon. And if you count all the changes in punctuation, capitalization, other things of that nature, the changes are almost 12,000. He needed to take our English class, sounds like to me. He did not do very well with English. And so the almost the 4,000, 3,900, that's where there's been deletions, actual change of words, and whole statements added, phrases deleted. That's 3,900. But if you deal with everything, right down to all the grammar, it's almost 12,000 changes. That's pretty amazing, isn't it? Especially when it's supposed to be the most correct of any book on earth. And here I'm showing you today the most correct book on earth. By the way, I'm going to give it away free. And in time, it'll be worth a lot. Most correct. But when you study it real close, you'll find out later, it's got about 12,000 mistakes in it. But really, it is the most correct. It can't be the most correct and have 12,000 mistakes. It can't be. How can such a thing be? Now see, the Book of Mormon is supposed to have the fullness of the gospel. To my mind, this is one of the most incredible things about the Book of Mormon. All the rest, almost in a certain sense, almost like trivia compared to this, in a sense. The Book of Mormon is said to have the fullness of the gospel. Now if I said, now we've got all three in this book. We've got the Book of Mormon and Doctrine and Covenants for a great price. But what if this was just the Book of Mormon? I said, now this has the fullness of the gospel. Now what would that mean to you? It would mean to me that I don't have to go anywhere else to get the gospel. I mean, that seems to be a pretty fair way of analyzing that. And then so I start searching the book that has the fullness of the gospel. See, I know about this church. There's this church over here, and they say they got the fullness of the gospel out of this book. So I'm interested. I want to verify it. So I have a list of what they believe. And I look for it in the fullness of the gospel book. And I can't find any of those doctrines. Now, what does that make me think about this book? That somehow I must have got the wrong book. It must be an explanation of a different book. But the Book of Mormon is said to have the fullness of the gospel. And it doesn't have any of their major doctrines. It's just phenomenal. It's an amazing thing. Now, it's the Book of Doctrine and Covenants that tells us this. Doctrine and Covenants, chapter 20, verse 9. Chapter 27, verse 5. Chapter 42, verse 15. Here's chapter 20, verse 9. And it's talking about the Book of Mormon. Just mentioned that in verse 8. Don't want to take anything out of context here. It says, which contains a record of a fallen people and the fullness of the gospel of Jesus Christ to the Gentiles and to the Jews also. Fullness of the gospel. Book of Mormon contains it. Fullness of the gospel. When we talk about Jesus having the fullness of the God essence dwelling within him, well, you all know that only means he had part of God, don't you? He really wasn't God in flesh. He's just part of God in flesh. Fullness means fullness. It's just kind of always meant that. It's just something about that word. Now, here's a list of the things that they don't have. Here's their doctrines, and none of these are in the Book of Mormon. The church organization upon which they place so much emphasis is not in the Book of Mormon. It has nothing to do with their church organization. It doesn't tell you anything about it. But yet they've got president, and they've got their 12 apostles, and their council of 70, and they've got all these other things. They've got the priesthoods. And none of that organization with the stakes and the wards and the temples and all that, none of it is in the Book of Mormon. Not one bit of it is in the Book of Mormon. The Melchizedek priesthood is not in the Book of Mormon. No Melchizedek priesthood. There is no Aaronic priesthood. None. Remember, the priesthood is the only means by which God is able to reach man. So if you don't have a priesthood, then God can't reach man. So here's the book that has the fullness of the gospel, and it doesn't have anything about the priesthood, which would say there's no way for God to reach man. From the book that has the fullness of the gospel. The doctrine of the plurality of gods is not found in the Book of Mormon. Mormons are polytheists. They're polytheists just like the Egyptians and the Buddhists and everybody else. I mean, they're polytheists. And they may believe in certain supreme gods in a certain sense, or supreme god, but they've still got gods by the zillions in all sorts of different forms. But Mormonism is polytheistic. The Mormon doctrine that God is an exalted man is not in the Book of Mormon. That God is an exalted man, that's not in the Book of Mormon. The doctrine that men become gods, is not in the Book of Mormon. The doctrine of the three degrees of glory, that is the three different heavens, which we'll talk about later on. That's not in the Book of Mormon. The plurality of wives is not in the Book of Mormon. That is, polygamy is not in the Book of Mormon. It's in Doctrine and Covenants. And the Book of Mormon even says, don't have more than one wife. So now that even contradicts one of their major doctrines. The doctrine of the Word of Wisdom, that is, their health laws. Remember Doctrine and Covenants, section 89. Can't drink any hot drinks and all that. That's not in the Book of Mormon, but yet that's a very important thing to them. That's not there. And the doctrine of pre-existence, that we all existed as spirits before we came into these bodies, that's not in the Book of Mormon. And the doctrine of eternal progression, and that's that everybody continues to move up progressively, and that includes all the gods. See, there is no such thing really in Mormonism as an unchanging God. God is still changing. The God who really founded this is still changing. There's a divine progression. So there is no immutable God. God is always changing. He's always moving up. The doctrine of a heavenly mother. I believe in a heavenly mother. I actually do. We'll read an interesting statement from one of their apostles. It just sounds so weird. So it's such a weird thing. I mean, I love my mother, but a heavenly mother is just hard for me to get a handle on. Baptism for the dead is not in the Book of Mormon. Now, these are their major doctrines. These are major doctrines. And this is not, well, just a few things that they kind of believe in, and it's kind of part of what they're doing. This is what they're believing. And none of it is in the Book of Mormon. Not one bit of it. So how can you have a book with the fullness of the gospel and it doesn't have their gospel? That is a big question. Now this is very interesting. The sources of the Book of Mormon. This is very, very interesting. The number one source, and what we mean is, where did this book really come from? This book did not come from gold plates. See, if Joseph Smith had dug up gold plates, he would have sold them. That's what he would have done. He wasn't going to go behind some sheet and translate them. He's going to find the nearest guy that he could get $500,000 or $1 million from or whatever he could get and take a nice trip off to Utopia, off to some paradise. That's what he would have done. He'd been looking his whole life for a treasure. If Moroni came and offered him this treasure, these plates, he would have just, his eyes would have turned into dollar signs. All he would have seen is treasure found. That's really the truth. So we have to think about, now where did this really come from? Where did he get these ideas? Now, I mentioned this before. His mother wrote that he was a very imaginative storyteller. I don't know the name of the book that it's in. If you're interested, you could probably write a note to Russ. He might know. And he had a habit of telling all sorts of stories about early Americans. And he loved to tell these kind of stories. And this is definitely one of the sources for the Book of Mormon. It's his imagination. This guy had an imagination. You know, a lot of people, I shouldn't have said it that way, but the people that are con artists, you know why they're so successful? I mean, you know, con artists basically are really successful. You know why? They've got such a good imagination. And the other thing is they can lie. They can lie through their teeth. They can turn on tears. They can turn on sincerity. They can befriend you. Con artists are really clever guys. I mean, they live from hand to mouth. I should say from your wallet to their mouth. See? That's what they do. That's how they live. And it's incredible that people like that can exist. But what does it show? There are millions of gullible people. I mean, there are people that believe anything. It's incredible what people will believe. And they won't take any time to investigate it. It's amazing how these guys can say, now, All I need from you, they've never seen this guy before, never seen, all I need from you is $3,000. And if you can give me that money, we're going to be able to come up with $15,000. I just need that. I just need some front money. That's all I need. I never saw this guy before. He doesn't have any documents. He doesn't have anything to show who he is. He doesn't show him the money first. And this person goes and gets their life savings. And they bring the money to him. He says, okay, now, I'll take it, and I'll be right back. Perfect, thanks. Yeah, this is going to work out good. Yeah, you're going to just have your money multiplied. I'll be back, and you're split, of course. I'm going to give you 2/3. I mean, you're going to do really well. And so I'll be right back. He never shows up. He never comes back. And the police officer, he investigates, he says, why did you give him all that money? Well, he just seemed so honest. He just seemed so sincere. I just couldn't imagine somebody being able to come up to me and keep a straight face if he was a liar. How do you think this guy was able to drive up in a Lincoln Continental? I mean, this guy, his profession is lying. I think that's what Joseph Smith was. He was a liar. He had a wild imagination, and he could tell it straight-faced. He was a liar. He had all sorts of demons helping him out, that's for sure. So that's one of the sources. Also, the Old Testament. The Old Testament is found in many, many, many places in the Book of Mormon. One example, Mosiah, chapter 14, is a verbatim restatement of Isaiah 53. We've got Isaiah chapter 53, quoted verbatim, Mosiah 14, word for word. Now that can't happen. Yeah, it's King James. Word for word. Can't happen. Then also the New Testament. The Tanners, and they have really researched this, they show 400 parallels between the New Testament and the Book of Mormon. They show 200 plus quotations from the New Testament in the first two books of Nephi alone. Now, this shows that the King James Bible is a major source, and Joseph Smith simply plagiarized it. And it's estimated that there are 25,000 words of the King James Bible just copied right into the Book of Mormon. Now, I don't have the slightest idea how many words are in the Book of Mormon, and I did try to start counting them this afternoon, but I fell asleep at 1,500. The new way I'm going to start going to sleep at night, instead of counting sheep, I'm going to count words in the Book of Mormon. And hopefully just before I fall asleep, I can mark where I quit. So maybe in about 3 or 4 years, I'll have a number for you. I don't know the number. But I don't know what 25,000 sounds like to you, but to me it sounds like a lot. Sounds like he just kept opening that King James Bible up and find something that would sound good and just put that in there and open it up again and put that in there. And that's how he went about it. He did that very thing. Now, another source is a book titled View of the Hebrews. View of the Hebrews. Now, this book was written by Ethan Smith. Ethan Smith. Smith. Did you catch that? Smith. He was a cousin of Joseph Smith. So, Ethan Smith. Now, there are 95 parallels between this book and the Book of Mormon, 41 of which are very specific. There is much quoting of Isaiah in this book. And so you can see how that would then carry over into the Book of Mormon. And this book talks about inhabitants of America being descendants of Hebrews. This just was fiction. Joseph's cousin wrote a fiction book called View of the Hebrews. And Joseph, you know, just to make his cousin feel good, sat down and read it. And he liked it so much, he decided to write a book just about like it. That's really what's going on. I have no idea what was in his mind, what his real goals were. And this book was written just prior to the Book of Mormon. Just prior. Maybe they even talked about it. Maybe they shared some ideas. And Ethan Smith, he lived right here in Palmyra, New York. They were shirt-tail cousins. They were real close. And portions of this book were published in the Wayne Sentinel, which was the newspaper. The Wayne, W-A-Y-N-E, Sentinel, S-E-N-T-I-N-E-L. And there's documentary evidence that the Smith family had a subscription to the Wayne Sentinel. And so his portions were published there. That would even further allow Smith to have portions of it available to him. Kind of interesting. The book talks about immigration by boat, ancient Americans who were highly civilized, that God will regather his people on the American continent. Pretty interesting. References to sticks of Joseph and Ephraim in Ezekiel chapter 37. Both North and South America are referred to. Inspired prophets and priests. Breastplate. Urim and Thummim. The Indians knew of the Trinity. Indians were to be the people of the Lord. Early mounds for the inhabitants where they would bury things. High level of craft. Gold, silver, copper, swords, tools, etc. Kind of interesting, huh? Yes.
When his cousin put this book out, did he put it out of fiction?
Oh, I'm sure he did. Yes, definitely. Yeah, and it was clear that that was fiction. And there are a lot of people that did things like this. There's a lot of books written like this. A lot of books written today. They give you all sorts of fiction about what happened. Books on all sorts of Bible characters. Tell you all who they talked to and where they lived and tell you about the early life of Moses and the early life here of Samuel and what Samson really did and how his hair grew long. He'd break chairs up and, you know, not really, I don't know, but it's a common thing. I remember reading when I was in secondary college the book The Source by James A. Michener. That's a wild book. And it's this thing of all the prehistoric, the Indians and the religions and the Jews and the Americans and the, and so I can't remember what it was. I was not much into reading such things. But that was all fiction. And so I'm sure that that's what this was too. I don't think it was presented as any sort of history. People like to read these kind of things. They like to be able to be taken on these flights of fancy. That's why there's so many big publishing houses today. Now, another source is Masonry. The Freemasons. Those good old Masons. And it's interesting that in September of 1826, a man named William Morgan, September 1826, he was an anti-Freemason. And he was lecturing, and he was writing, and he was revealing the secrets of Masonry. And Mr. Morgan was then found murdered in the river there near New York. He was in this area in New York, and he was found dead in a river there, and whether it's New York City or somewhere in there, but just state of New York. And these Masons, especially back then, they were serious people. And if somebody who'd been in Masonry decided to quit and then spill the beans about Masonry, his life was in danger. And that's what happened to this guy. He was telling all about Masonry. And he was writing about it and lecturing about it, and they killed him. That's exactly what happened to this guy. And it's what happened to Mormons under Brigham Young, and it's happened all sorts of times, all throughout history. And five Masons went on trial for this in January 1827. And in the years of 1827 and 1828, there was a mass anti-Mason sentiment. And there was, people were really upset. This became a really big deal. So in the Book of Mormon, in the book Helaman, chapter 6, H-E-L-A-M-A-N, Helaman, chapter 6, it refers to Gadianton, G-A-D-I-A-N-T-O-N. And this was the Gadianton band. And they had secret signs and words. Just like those being investigated and talked about in New York at the same time. And Joseph Smith, he put that right in the Book of Mormon. And the amazing thing is, the so-called super secret things of the Mormon temples, they're just like masonry. Weird handshakes, secret names, secret words, same nonsensical stuff. Really. So he'd read about something, he'd put it right in the Book of Mormon. And that's exactly what he did. And I'll give you another one here after we take our break, and it's even more interesting. It's even more specific in a sense, so take a break. The bulletins are up here if you haven't gotten one.
Okay.